We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Once again, that's the time of the month to be talking about home maintenance, and our guest is Scott Spies. He's an inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he stops by here once a month on a Monday to take questions. And as I sometimes say, just about any piece or part of the single-family home, we can take questions. Maybe you're thinking about a furnace, or because it's going to be cold one of these days, you're thinking about your insulation, but also can be gutters or roofing or attics or basements or windows or any and all of that kind of stuff. If you've heard the show before, you know the drill. So just give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we will be happy to take them. And I know Scott will do his very best to give you an answer and help you out. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, David. I always appreciate coming on.
We're always glad to have you here, and we have a couple of callers here, and we'll get right in it. We'll not make them wait, and we'll start with Champaign, and this is line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about French doors leading outside to a south-facing deck, and we noticed that on the outside, all of the caulking or grout is really crumbling, falling away. And so I'm calling to find out if that's a home repair, what products you use, or if you hire somebody to come in and do that. We pressure washed and noticed that some water was able to come right through to the inside.
Through around the glass panes?
Yes.
Okay. I'm assuming this is a wood French door.
Yes.
Okay. And the glass panes are held in the wood with a product known as a glazing putty or window putty.
Mm-hmm.
And as the wood ages and dries, it absorbs the oils out of the glazing putty, and the glazing putty gets hard and brittle, particularly when exposed to things like sunlight, which helps not only dry the oils out of the glazing putty, but also dries the wood out, so the wood dries the oils out of the putty. So what you've got is a very common problem if the window putty is coming loose on the panes of glass. It can be a do-it-yourself job if you're relatively mechanically inclined. Otherwise, there are glass companies who will be more than happy to come out and reglaze the windows, and many of the handymen in the area do that. The first thing you'll want to do is to get out the old dried glazing, which in most cases comes out pretty well in a but you always end up with like one or two that is still pretty hard and you can't quite get it out, but it's cracked at the bottom and not at the top. There is a little product called a putty chaser, which it basically hooks up to a drill and has a stop on it so it doesn't hit your glass, and you can run it around the edges, and it's got just enough of a bit to take the putty out. Before reputtying or before putting in new glazing compound, I do recommend brushing a light coat of linseed oil on the wood. This seals the wood so that it does not absorb the oils out of the new putty. Otherwise, you put in new putty on old dry wood and it just saps all the oils right back out of it, so your glazing job only lasts about 5 to 8 years, whereas if you coat it with linseed oil, it seals it.
The doors are painted. You would still use linseed oil?
Yeah, you just do it where after you've taken the putty out, you'll see some bare wood.
Mm-hmm.
And that bare wood, just take a small brush and brush the linseed oil onto that bare wood and let it dry thoroughly before putting in your glazing putty.
Mm-hmm.
And your glazing putty is pretty easy to do. Once you get the old stuff out, it's pretty easy to do. It basically has got about the same consistency of a modeling clay. And you get a little ball of it, and you roll it in your fingers until it makes a little long line, and then you kind of press it in place and then take something that's usually a metal object or a plastic, something that doesn't scratch the glass, and run across the top of it and strike the top of it so it has a nice flat surface. A little bit of practice, and you'd be surprised at how good you can get at it without without a whole lot of effort.
And companies who do this, would that be like Bacon and Van Buskirk?
Glass companies do it all the time. Most handyman can do it. And like I say, it may be one of those things you want to look up on the internet and see what the processes are for glazing windows.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But yeah, it's a special putty. It's not a standard caulk, and you don't want to use anything really hard. It's got to be something that flexes, and that will seal your windows. Now, I also do recommend for a French door like that to have a set of storm doors, because generally speaking, with that much glass, there's really not a lot of energy barrier there, so you tend to have a lot of heat loss. So you might want to consider that, and the storm doors will also help reduce the wear and tear on the putty and on the windows.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Having done this a few times with an old house and old windows, I guess I would say glazing, it's not hard. However, it is easy to do a really bad job, and it's the trick that you have to learn after a while is how to get a nice crisp finish on there so that it looks good. It's good. It's easy to do it in a way that looks kind of sloppy, but
yeah.
Having a nice, clean, sharp edge. Now that's the part that takes a little practice.
Yeah, and you can use I indicated something metal, but usually a plastic scraper, like almost like an ice scraper type edge, and dip it in just a little bit of a light oil, and that way it doesn't stick to the glazing compound, and then you can go across the top of it and basically force it into there, and gives you a nice flat, smooth surface that. Yeah, once you've done that, it looks really nice. If you just push it in with your fingers and it looks kind of a little lumpy, and then you try and paint over it, and yeah, everybody goes, "What's wrong with your window?" But yeah, yeah, with a little bit of practice with striking the glazing so that it has a smooth surface, it can be every bit as professional as having hired somebody to have done it for you.
All right, we'll go on. Urbana, next, line two. Hello? Yes.
Oh, I have a roof question. I'm going to have to put a new roof on a little ranch house that has a room that pokes out so that there is a valley.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular roof we put on back in the early 90s. And there's a leak that has developed in the valley. So I don't have the money to put the roof on right now, but I will in the spring. So can I just go up there in an effort to patch this up and make it so it doesn't leak all winter? Is get a roll of that asphalt shingle stuff and just cover it and go up there with this roll?
Well, actually, I probably wouldn't do a roll-type roofing. Generally speaking, the valleys do wear out faster than the shingles. They have a little more water running through them since everything runs towards the valleys. So it's not uncommon to have the valleys start to give you problems 3 to 5 years before the shingles are actually worn out. And if you don't do something with the valleys, then you can end up with leaks. The valleys are usually double coverage. In other words, there should be a heavy layer of roofing felt or a roll roofing, and then the mineral roofing that you see on top. I would make sure that since you're not going to be able to do it this fall, to put a good coating of a fibered roofing cement.
Oh, that black gloppy?
Well, it comes in black or gray or a couple of different colors. But, yes, the fibered roofing cement is intended for patching spots like that. The problem with putting a roll roofing or something over the top of it right now is you have no way of getting it underneath the shingles, yeah, underneath the tabs, because your tabs are old and dried and brittle and pretty well stuck down. Yeah, if you're talking about replacing it, I know the condition of those shingles already.
Yeah.
And so if you end up throwing something on top of it, capillary attraction just wicks it back in on the edges. So the easiest thing to do is get somebody to go up there with a fibered roofing cement and a spatula and basically smear this stuff in there and seal it to the valley, to the edges of the shingles, and any places that look like we're missing a lot of the granules or have holes. And that'll work for about a year or two, which should get you to your springtime goal.
Sure. Okay. Well, apparently I'll be up there then. How much do you think how do you buy that? Is that in 2 gallons or 5 gallons?
Usually it comes in 1 gallon can, sort of like a paint.
Oh, 1 gallon. So it's not that heavy. I can get that up there.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy it in
5 gallon buckets as well, but if you need 5 gallons of it, that might be a need for a roofer.
All right, thank you. On to Urbana, another caller, and this is line three. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have two questions. We have an old house. It's about 100 years old, and actually you and your dad did the home inspection on it. We're replacing the roof which is a big job because there's original cedar shake and two layers of asphalt. But I was wondering, after we do it, we have a floor in the attic, and I'm not sure how much insulation is there. Would it be good to add insulation when we're doing this job to make the house more energy efficient?
Well, adding more insulation in an attic area is always a plus. It's not necessarily related to a roof job. However, I probably would wait till afterwards because you end up with a lot of debris occasionally falling through, particularly with a – since you've got a cedar roof, you've got slats that the cedar shingles are placed on. And so they're going to have to remove all the cedar and then put down new plywood. When they do that, you want to make sure that they don't block up any excess ventilation. Either install a ridge vent or a couple of roof vents.
Yeah, they're adding an additional vent.
Okay, good.
Quite enough.
Yeah.
And then the other question I have is we have basement windows that are either needing to be re-caulked or replaced. And I had someone come out once and they said because it's old brick foundation, there's no way to buy standardized windows. They all have to be measured to fit custom. Does that sound reasonable, or would it be better just to re-caulk what we have?
I would say that there's probably not a standard window in there because today's standard basement windows are probably of a different size than they were at the time the house was built. Your windows are probably a lot larger. Mm-hmm. So it would be more of a custom application, which doesn't necessarily mean that they're that much more expensive. Usually you can get windows designed just about to any size you need. So that should not be a big issue. But, yes, you would probably need to order windows rather than being able to just buy off-the-shelf windows. Mm-hmm. But that goes for most homes. You could caulk and seal the ones you've got, actually re-puttying and painting the ones you've got, the wood windows. But then you'd probably also want to put some type of a storm panel, either a piece of plexiglass or an actual storm window, because the windows you've got now are a single-pane window.
That's right.
And so they've got a lot of heat loss.
That's actually a good idea.
So
it sounds to me like that might be more cost-effective, too, rather than putting in customized windows.
I did just price out a couple of custom-designed windows, and using the low-end vinyl frames without the low-E glass and things like that, I was able to get custom-sized windows for about $160.
Well, that's not bad.
So if your labor rates of scraping, painting, and puttying are more than $25 or $30 an hour, then you may not actually save money by doing it. It may be cheaper to get a window and have it put in. So
okay.
That's something. In other words, I wouldn't be afraid to price it out. Get a bid on or two on it. And for a basement window, you don't need to get the highest quality because there's always going to be some air leakage through a brick basement anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So just something that is going to stop a lot more weather than what you've got now and does have a double pane glass so that we don't have quite as much heat transfer through the glass itself.
Well, that's a great idea. I appreciate that so much.
But like I say, if you decide not to do the storm windows, or the replacement windows, storm windows, and storm windows for basements, again, most basements aren't finished aren't finished to where you're down there all the time. So a piece of plexiglass with a couple of screws on the inside is a perfectly acceptable way of doing it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Our guest in this hour of focus is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday to talk about home maintenance, and questions are welcome. We got several people ready to go and lined up. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Next is somebody in Charleston on our line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah.
I have a question for you in regard to, I have a ranch-style house that last week one day I noticed that there was water dripping down from the return air vent onto the carpet. Not very much, but enough to make a wet area. I opened up that vent and noticed that there was just a small amount of water on the filter, and taking that out then and going up there with a ladder, I could see that there was moisture around that plastic chute. And then I go out up a little farther, and I could see that there's like a small puddle of stained water a little farther up in that thing. And I was wondering, what would have caused that to happen?
All right. Is this a air conditioner system only, or is it also heating system?
It's both.
Okay. I would not expect to see condensation in a return air. on a heat system. Generally, that is something that we run into on attic-mounted air conditioning systems only. Condensation is the only thing that can come to mind because that's the only way you're going to get water into our turn duct unless we happen to have a roof leak, which happens to be dripping down on top of it. So you might want to check the roof for any valleys or anything like that in that area. And I would not have expected a condensation issue this early in the year. We really haven't had enough cold days to create a lot of moisture condensation unless you've just got an exceedingly high humidity level in the house. The ductwork for the returns are usually run through the attic area, and when run through the attic area, that they can get much colder. So if you've got high humidity in the house, cold spots are where things will start to condense first. So that's why we can get some condensation in ductwork in attic areas. Usually the furnace system runs and keeps it evaporated out so it's not accumulating. This time of year, of course, we haven't run the humidity or run the furnace a lot because we haven't had really cold temperatures. But because we haven't had really cold temperatures, we should not have had a lot of condensation. So I would say that this is something to be concerned with, that we need to start figuring out where the moisture is coming from. And I mean, if you have 70% humidity right now in your house, yes, you could get condensation in any ductwork in the attic. If you've got 70% humidity in the house, we need to figure out why. So I would start looking for moisture sources, and if you don't know, have any obvious ones, a wet basement, a power humidifier that's been running continuously, things like that, then I would start looking for roof leaks.
Okay, because I did notice that the two areas had little puddles in them were kind of a stained color to the water, if that would provide any more information.
Yeah, usually that's an indication of coming through a piece of plywood for a roof leak or something.
All right, we will check it out farther then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. To the next caller, Monticello, on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I have a central air system. Of course, I'm not using it now, but when I discontinued use, when the weather got cool a month or so back, it was working fine. Worked fine all summer, and we had a pretty hot one. After several days of cool weather, it got hot again. I turned the central air back on and noticed for several days running, the coil was icing up. I hadn't had the house open. It wasn't unusually humid in the house, but I couldn't operate it for more than a half an hour or 45 minutes without diminished airflow because of coil icing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what that's all about?
Generally, coil icing is the cooling coil is overcooling. This is a situation that happens when you start getting low on Freon. Your Freon level will drop and the pressure will drop in there, and it can actually expand too quickly. You end up with a very, very cold coil, a little bit of moisture, and it actually freezes water. Another cause can be a blocked return if you're not getting enough air through it to actually warm the coil up. Obviously, what we're trying to do is run refrigerant through an A-coil and then blow air over the top of the A-coil, and that house air then gets cooled by going past the coil. If you're not getting air past it, the coil will get cold, and you can get some condensation. So the first thing I would do is check to make sure we don't have a blocked filter, blocked return. But my guess is, just, you know, rule of thumb, you're likely to have a low Freon condition.
I see, and that could happen because of a dried seal on out by the compressor.
Actually,
once before, and it was okay. Kind of like a little valve stem that I had to have it recharged a little over a year ago. It was the beginning of last season, not this past season, but the season before. Wasn't making cold air. They came out. It's a 20-year-old unit. They said, well, the coil, they couldn't replace that coil. They'd have to replace the whole unit because it was too old and so on. But they recharged it, said that might work, and it did. And it held for two seasons until the end of this one, and then I started noticing the...
Yeah, my guess is that your system is old enough that you've got some very, very minor leakage around some of the soldered connections in the copper line between the compressor and the coil, and we're just getting a little bit of seepage. The leak is probably small enough they would not be able to find it. A tester may or may not be able to even find the leak to be able to fix it. So it's one of those deals, particularly with a 20-year-old air compressor, air conditioning system, you're probably looking at wanting to replace it rather than putting much money into trying to find a small leak. This energy efficiency rating of the newer air conditioners is so much higher than the old ones. We now rate air conditioners by the SEER rating, or seasonal energy efficiency rating, SEER. A 20-year-old unit probably has an SEER rating of somewhere in the 6 to 8 zone, and right now you are not allowed to buy or sell anything less than 13. So this seasonal energy efficiency rating is actually the number of BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. So if you get 6 BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity on your old one, and you can get 13 on your new one, obviously, you just cut your air conditioning bill in half. So therefore, it doesn't make a lot of sense to fix one that's rated at 6 or 8, but just to go on up to one that's 13. So, because if you use it at all, it's going to pay for itself relatively quickly.
Should I attempt to recharge this one more time, or just...
At this late in the year, I don't know that I would.
In anticipation of the next season.
Well, you can do so, and it may last a while, as long as our leak has not gotten greater. Of course, the older it gets and the more brittle things get, the leak can accelerate. But you're buying the new air conditioner whether you put it in or not. It's one of those things where, you know, if you're running the air conditioner and it's costing you $120 a month to use it, and you put in the new one, it will cost you $60 a month. So you're spending $60 a month on a new air conditioner that you're not getting as long as you're using that older unit.
I see.
I know it's not exactly what you wanted to hear. Yes, you could.
Probably not. What's a ballpark price for a new coil and compressor?
Oh, I'm not going to get into the pricing. There's too many variables in that. But basically, my guess is a new system is in order very shortly. If it's something you can't do, yes, you can probably get it charged and have it work for a while. But depending on how fast that leak is as to how long the charge lasts.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. And we'll just keep on going here. The next caller is in Lafayette on line number 2. Hello.
About puttying those old wood windows, you mentioned linseed oil to oil up the old wood. What about after puttying, painting over it?
Well, of course, most people do paint over the top of the putty once they've put it in, because the putty doesn't necessarily match the color. Usually most window putties are kind of a tan color, and most people like either a darker window or a nice white window. So, yes, painting over the top of it does seal the top of the putty, so we're not losing it, the oils naturally to evaporation. But because the wood does dry out with age, most of the oils in the putty does go into the woodwork itself.
And about the roofing cement, I wonder if, with a choice of colors, what about gray or aluminum color to reflect more sun, more radiation?
Well, I'm going to have to say that I'm hoping that roofing tar is used as a temporary patch, so I'm not terribly worried about reflecting heat or light or anything like that, because hopefully it's not up there long enough to make a big energy impact one way or another. I'm more so interested in getting rid of the leak until the roof can be repaired. But yes, an aluminum type color will tend to reflect some of the UV, some of the radiant heat. So if you are trying to seal something that you are worried about building up heat in an attic, a lighter color is usually more preferable over a dark color.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thanks for calling in.
Well, that just raises real quick a question about roofing colors. Now, and maybe because of the color of your house, you feel you don't have a whole lot of choice. Maybe depending on what you've got, you don't want to have something really light colored. But does that really make a whole lot of difference in terms of heat absorption?
Okay, we're getting into some theoreticals here. In my experience, I have found that lighter color roofs tend to last a little bit longer. When I go and look at do an inspection on a house, and they tell I'm looking at it going, hey, this roof has got a couple more years left in it. It's like, well, it's already 22 years old. And I'm like, well, that's interesting because most of the time they only last about 20 years. Most of the dark roofs I find do last about 20 years. So it's kind of subjective. I'm sure that there are shingle companies out there that have reasons why they have dark shingles versus light shingles and claim one will outlast another. I do know walking on a dark shingle roof is a lot warmer on the feet, hot enough to where the shoes actually radiate heat through the sole of the shoe. When they do have that much heat and you walk on them, it does tend to knock the mineral granules off, so that can accelerate the wear if there's been people. Painters from, painting a second floor over a first floor roof, things like that. Mm-hmm. The dark shingles hold heat longer, so attics tend to pick up a little bit more temperature. However, your attic should be well enough ventilated and the ceiling well enough insulated. It's not going to make a big difference on your heat bill one way or other. Some people say, hey, I want to pick up that heat so in the wintertime I don't have as much heat bill. Okay, but that just means you increased your air conditioning load. If it's hot enough up there to help reduce heat loss, then it's going to be warm enough in the summertime to really impair your cooling. You're going to be losing a lot of heat up to it. But like I say, with proper ventilation and proper insulation, the color of the shingle shouldn't make that much of a difference in attic temperature. We should have ventilation through the attic, so it's fairly even. It's always a little bit warmer when the sun's out versus when the sun is not out. But I have actually found that the lighter color shingles tend to have a few more years of life. So I would say the reflective properties or the non-absorbing heat properties of the lighter colors will help the life of the shingles.
All right. Well, let's get back to the phones here, and we'll talk next with someone in Champaign. Line 3. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. This seems to be a day for roof questions, and I'm going to have another one. I have a two-story house with a roof that's about 10 years old, and I've noticed on the first floor, above a ceiling fan in a fairly large room, I've got what appears to be some type of moisture spots. Doesn't look like the way water work looks when it comes down. You get sort of those concentric dark circles in a spot, but it's sort of an even discoloration. And I can't figure out at all where this water could be coming from. There's no evidence of a leak that I can find in the attic. There's no evidence in the room above this family room of any water. You have to go two rooms over until you can find an upstairs bathroom. And I guess my question is, where can I turn to get somebody to help me try to find out whether or not this is a leak or where it might be coming from? Would I turn to a roofer? Would I turn to a home inspector? What advice would you offer?
First of all, what color is this discoloration? Is it a brown or a black?
It's just it's on a white roof, so it's just sort of a very light tan. So it's a very light discoloration.
Okay. And you say it's on the second floor?
No, it's on the first floor.
It's on the first floor.
Right.
Okay, so there's no attic area above it. It's got.
That's correct.
All right. Well, it's going to take somebody with some plumbing knowledge, either a plumber or an inspector, somebody that will know where to look for things. My guess is it's probably going to be a condensation thing. Usually when I find something like that, there's a cold water line that runs above that, and we've had a high humidity in the house, and a toilet flapper valve doesn't seal well, so you end up with the toilet running continuous. So we end up with a really cold water line, and the really cold water line gets a little condensation on it, and that drips. But usually that does give the concentric circles, as you're referring to. The water drips down. Sometimes it'll drip down through a line where two pieces of drywall meet, and you end up with an oblong stain.
And I know that there are no water lines near this area at all. They're all on the other side of the house.
Okay. Okay. Heating and air conditioning ducts, things like that above it?
Possibly.
I won't say it's impossible that we don't have some moisture, particularly if we have I find on houses that have like a hot water heat system plus a separate air conditioning system, we can end up with problems like that. But usually if we have a standard forced air system, I don't find a lot of condensation issues in ductwork. It's usually when they're separate units. And I'm going to assume that you have a standard forced air system in the house.
That's correct.
So it shouldn't be condensation in the ductwork. Yeah, that's one of those things without seeing it and knowing what the color is and what the layout of the house is. I don't know how much I could do from here, but it's something that a home inspector could look at and usually we'll be able to figure something like that out.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. On to caller in Chicago, line four. Hello.
Hi. I've got about a 100-year-old house with a brick foundation that has some, you know, some of the brick facing, I mean, inside the basement is got mineral on it and is dry and kind of crumbly. Is there any way to prevent that or to treat that?
You're talking about some basically white salt type crystals?
Right, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that's known as efflorescence. The efflorescence is moisture coming through the brick, dissolving some of the lime and the salts, calcium out of the mortar, and then drying on the brick, leaving the minerals behind.
Right.
So therefore, the best thing to do, of course, is to keep water away from the brick wall. I would look for gutters that are blocked or downspouts that are not extended away or some settlement of the grating next to the house, which is directing water towards the brick. Now, brick will always allow a little bit of water through it, so the best thing we can do is to keep as much water away from it as possible.
Okay.
And that should stop most of the efflorescence. The efflorescence itself is not, in most cases, is not enough to actually start ruining the mortar unless we get just excessive amounts of moisture through it and can usually be brushed off. I don't recommend painting on brick surfaces. Because brick really does need to breathe. If it gets some moisture in it, we really want it to be able to come out. And if you paint it and seal it from the inside, and the water comes in from the outside, it's usually harder on the brick. You can usually brush the efflorescence off with a good stiff brush. You can actually wash it off. It'll redissolve and then, you know, of course, mop the basement floors. But usually it's an indication that we've had excess humidity from the exterior. So I would take a walk around the outside and say, okay, which way is my yard sloping? Is it flat? Does it have a slope away from the house or does it have a slope back towards the house? As the house has aged, we probably have had a little bit of settlement of the soil.
Right.
And so most of the time what I'll find is a slight what I lovingly refer to as the moat around the castle. This slight negative grade going back towards the house, which does direct water to the brick foundations. But it can be something as simple as a tennis ball stuck in the gutter where the gutter no longer flows down the downspout. Everything just all rolls over the edge and it splashes on the brick. So just take a walk around the outside and see if you can find possible moisture sources, and that should help prevent it or reduce it greatly.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, we're a little bit past our midpoint here. Scott Spies is the guest from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. And if you have questions, you can call us, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. Something you want to mention?
Well, I just thought since we've already had a couple of calls now where it's a possibility of condensation and ductwork, to remind people that do have hot water systems or separate air conditioning and heating systems, this is about the time of year you want to start considering blocking up all your vents, closing the vents, making sure I'd pull the filter out and wrap it in a plastic bag and put it back in so that air doesn't move through the filter. Because this is the time of year where if we happen to get some cold areas, some cold spells suddenly, when we have relatively high humidity because it's been warm and all of a sudden we get a cold snap, and let's face it, Central Illinois is notorious for losing about 60 degrees in 2 or 3 days. And when that does happen, we can get some condensation in those air conditioning duct systems. So if you've got your air conditioner separate from your heating and cooling system, now would be the time to start thinking about, okay, how am I going to block up all the registers in the ceiling? And I would just recommend dropping the filter into a plastic bag and put the filter back in place, and that will reduce your airflow through the return air.
Yeah. This is a question we've gotten a lot from people, but maybe I just ask it again. Some people thinking, well, if they have vents into their crawl spaces, should those be open or should they be closed?
Wintertime, I do recommend closing them. Actually, I do recommend closing them in the summertime as well because we can get enough hot, humid air down in the crawl spaces to create condensation issues. If you've got a damp basement, it's not a bad idea to open them in the spring and the fall. But summertime, I'd keep them closed. In the wintertime, we definitely want to keep them closed. We want to reduce airflow through the crawl space so we don't end up with cold floors, frozen pipes, things like that. So good point.
How about this one? There might be people who say, well, down in the basement, it's a space that I really don't – we don't spend a lot of time down in the basement. Maybe it's not even a finished basement. And though on our furnace, there's a vent that will vent warm air into the basement. So you can open it up and you can get some warm air into the basement and some air circulation, or you can close it and then you'd say, well, maybe I should do that and make sure that all the warm air goes where we live up into the house. I mean, is there some – how do you think about that? Is there some reason to have – if you have vents, cooling or heating vents that come off your furnace or your air conditioner that go into a basement that's not really a used space, do you heat and cool that or do you keep that closed off?
Well, you're not going to save as much energy by closing it off because heat does rise. So any heat you put in the basement does tend to come up and warm the floors above. So closing off a basement completely, all the heat ducts and letting it get much cooler can lead to cold foot syndrome. Unless you're walking around with socks on, your floors are cold. And if your feet get cold, you tend to get cold. So oftentimes, I've seen people block off entire rooms, and one bedroom is next to another bedroom, and if you happen to have the bed close to the cooler bedroom, believe it or not, the partition wall, of course, doesn't have insulation. That wall stays cool enough that you feel colder in your room because you've got the heat turned off in the other room. Your body acts as a radiant heat source. If you have a cold surface, you tend to radiate heat towards it. So the reason we put insulation in the walls is to try and reduce the heat loss through the walls so the walls are warmer so that you feel more comfortable in the house at a lower temperature. It's one of those things where if you got a basement and the furnace is in the basement, usually there's enough heat loss from the furnace. We don't need to add a bunch of ductwork to the basement, but if the ductwork is down there, I wouldn't necessarily shut it off completely because you may end up with cold floors above it.
Okay. Another call here in Champaign in line one. Hello.
So what do you do about cold foot syndrome?
Socks, wool clogs.
Okay. Well, figure out why the floors feel so cold. Depending on what type of a surface we've got. If we've got a crawl space, I would recommend putting some insulation on the outside perimeter walls inside the crawl space or exterior, either one, basically so that we're not radiating the heat from the soil to the outside walls. Same can go for a basement. Most basements have a band joist area. That would be the area between the masonry foundation and the wood floor framing. That band joist area is actually a relatively thin spot, usually less than 3 inches thick before the siding is nailed to it. And so putting some insulation in the band joist area will help reduce a lot of heat loss. And the more heat loss that we can prevent, of course, then the more heat wants to rise up and warm the floors. If you've got concrete slabs, it's a little bit more difficult. What kind of construction are you experiencing?
So wood frame, two-story house over a... a block foundation.
Crawl space or basement?
Basement.
Okay. A little more heat in the basement. The more you warm, I'm assuming you're talking on the first floor, not necessarily the second floor.
Correct.
Yeah. A little bit more heat into the basement. I would insulate the basement walls. Is the basement finished?
Yes.
Okay. Drop in tiles or drywall?
The masonry is exposed. It's
okay.
A usable basement, but Not finished as a living space.
Okay. I would do insulation on the basement walls and the band joist areas. What happens is the soil outside the house, particularly the top 6 or 8 inches, will get freezing or slightly below freezing. So you end up with the basement walls being cold, and the heat from that's generated in the basement tends to radiate towards those walls. By putting an insulating barrier between the living space and the masonry walls, we have more heat that tends to rise up and warm the floors.
Is Reflectix acceptable insulator?
Yes, it is. I don't know how much more effective it would be than just any trapped air. I would say that in a basement, we don't necessarily want to use a foam-type insulation. If we do use foam, it's got to have a fire-resistant covering, such as a fire-rated drywall over the top of it.
And how much air space would you need between the insulation and the concrete block wall?
depends on the type of insulation you're going to use. I like to see basically a house wrap put on the concrete wall before the insulation is put on. The house wrap will allow water vapor to move through but will not allow any liquid from the foundation to get into the insulation. So therefore, the insulation can breathe, but we don't end up with mold and mildew if we happen to have a little bit of seepage from the outside.
Okay.
So it's not a – and it, the insulation should have a vapor barrier. The vapor barrier would be on the warm side of the insulation. So if you're using a fiberglass bat with a craft paper on it, the craft paper should face towards the basement. You can use an unfaced fiberglass, which will allow air to move through it more easily so we don't have the condensation issues. But, yeah, something like a Tyvek, Typar type house wrap between the block and the fiberglass does a good job of keeping moisture from getting into the insulation.
How's the house wrap adhered to the masonry walls?
I would just put nails at the top of it where it goes with the sill plate and just let it hang down the wall and then put your furring strips or whatever you're going to need to do for your insulation.
Okay. Hey, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. And I guess one other thing I'll ask you about, because I know that people ask about this too. They say, well, you know, if the floor is cold, so we're talking about the first floor. If the floor is cold, you're thinking, well, it's because the basement is cold. So why not put insulation on the underside? So what would be, in effect, the ceiling of the basement? Why not put insulation on that? But you say, no. Don't
yeah, because if you put insulation in the floors between the basement and the first floor, then the only way that that floor then will receive heat is radiant heat. Well, heat tends to move up. So when you put heat in the room, it wants to go to the ceiling. It doesn't want to go to the floor. So you're not going to have a heat source. So you're still going to end up with a cold floor. There's no heat source for the floor.
Yeah. So do what you can to keep the basement warm, and then you get the advantage of the heat rising. So you do want it actually, if it's going to rise, you want it to rise and come up through the floor. You don't want to block that heat that's down there from coming up.
Right. The studies that I've seen indicate that if you have a relatively well-insulated house, in other words, acceptable amounts of insulation in the walls, acceptable amount of insulation in the attic areas, some decent windows, you know, where the curtains aren't moving when the wind blows, then as much as 10 to 15% of your current heat loss is actually through basement or crawl space foundation walls. Mm-hmm. So that is the next big area. We can go looking for 2 or 3% heat losses here and there, but 2 or 3% you're probably not going to notice. But 10 or 15%, that's something that's noticeable enough that it's worth doing the insulation of the basements and crawl spaces.
Okay. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have about 7-8 minutes with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. I expect that probably a lot of people by this point have run their furnaces at least one time. It's been cold enough. Anything in particular you would want to say to folks? Well, just to is there anything to look for that would suggest that there was some issue with the furnace?
Well, when you first fire up the furnace, oftentimes you get a little bit of an odor with it. It's usually because it hasn't been run for a while, and we get a little bit of dust on the heat exchanger. So that's not necessarily a big thing. I do recommend, of course, a clean filter when we switch from heating to air conditioning. I like to see a filter change at least 4 times a year. So between heat cooling season and then one time in the middle at least. If you've got long-haired pets, you may want to do it a little bit more often than that. If your furnace seems to be running a lot already, then we need to start looking, where is our heat loss going? Generally speaking, heat systems, if they're functioning, there's not as many problems that we can run into with air conditioning system. If we've got heat blowing, they're usually working relatively well. But if you notice that there's a lot of excessive heat, and I've run into this a few times, you go down in a basement and the room with the furnace is just much hotter than usual, and I find that the flue pipe temperatures are higher than what they should be. It's an indication we may have some air blockage. We're not getting as much air moving past the heat system, the heat exchanger, to actually cool it down, so the furnace itself gets quite hot. It does really wonders for the utility room, but it doesn't necessarily do wonders for the efficiency of the heating and cooling system throughout the rest of the house. So that's one thing to check. You know, walk past it. Is it warmer than you think it should be? Then we may not have enough airflow. A filter is usually the leading cause of a blocked airflow system. But if you had a poor filter at some point in time, you can actually get some dirt built up on the air conditioner coil, and that's not as easy to check or change. And so you can end up with a reduced airflow that way. Usually that's noticed in the air conditioning season because the air ends up coming out very cold because we're not moving it fast enough, and your air conditioning bill goes way up because we're not being efficient by moving the maximum amount of air. But it's still something you can show up in the wintertime.
All right. Champagne, here's caller, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I had a question on your thoughts on filter elements for heating units. I'm replacing my heater and air conditioner to take advantage of the tax rebate. Mm-hmm. I currently have an April air cleaner. I'm not real too satisfied with that. I looked into some electrostatic ones, but I got mixed reviews. You get noise through the ductwork from those, and some people say they don't work that well. So do you like the high performance, like HEPA filters that are like 4 inches thick? I'll turn off and listen, but I'm interested in your thoughts on what the best air filter is. We got some dust buildup in the upper story of the house, which is the first off-ramp.
Well, before you get off, how often are you changing your April air filter?
I usually do it like about once a year or a little more frequently, but it doesn't look that dirty when I take it apart.
Okay, which tells me that my guess is that the dust problem is not necessarily coming through the furnace system. I would look for air leakage around windows where we're actually getting some air blowing through. I know that at least one of the insulation companies here in town has a thermal infrared camera system that when you get a good cold snap, they can kind of point this thing at the walls and it can show you where all the cold air infiltration is. And I'd be willing to bet that what you've got is actually somebody has missed some caulking or some insulation around your windows. And so when it gets windy, we're actually blowing the dust in from around windows rather than it coming from the heating and cooling system, particularly since you're indicating it's on one level and not the other.
Yeah, it seems to be mostly the upper story, but we do get some dust throughout the house. So, you can dust the house, and next day we'll see dust on the flat surfaces upstairs. And we have pretty good, we have Pella windows and a pretty tight house, so it's about 23 years old, but caulking around the window seems to be pretty good. I don't know. So.
Well, like I say, that if you've already got the April air, now it's a box-style filter. It is usually about 4 inches thick. They're a relatively efficient filter as long as somebody hasn't cut an extra return that has bypassed the filter. So as long as the filter is sealed in place, it should actually be doing a pretty good job. There's some debate as to how efficient, but usually most of those box filters are in the 80% as far as how much material they take out or how much of the dust and pollens and such. So I would say that should be a pretty good deal. It's one of those things where I would probably just do a little bit of searching as soon as the weather gets cold, doing one of those, either an air door or a thermal camera or something like that, and say, hey, where is this dust coming from?
Okay. Do you have any thoughts on electronic air filters versus the high-performance media ones?
The electronic ones are a little bit more efficient, or effective, rather, but they do require a lot more maintenance. They require regular cleanings. They start getting dirty as you start getting the snap, crackle, pop of the bug zapper type effect, where as you indicated, some people can hear it through the ductwork. They're more expensive to install. They do require more maintenance. So from a cost-effective standpoint, I think your box filter is probably more efficient.
Thank you very much. All right. Appreciate your help.
Thank you. I have an email here from someone who says that they have a two-story, 2,000-square-foot, 20-year-old house. And in the crawl space, the block pillars that are on concrete footings have slightly but noticeably sunk. So the question is, should I have a structural engineer determined to advise on what to do? And they want to know if you felt like making a recommendation, whether you would recommend someone. I think probably you would not on the air do that. But what do you think about the basic question?
First of all, I'd be really surprised if they sunk. And I'm trying to figure out how person would actually know without stringing a line across the each and every pier, make sure that they're all even. Usually when people think that we've got some sinking of the piers, it's actually a wood shrinkage because we've got a wood beam on top of the main pier girder. The main girder sits on top of the concrete piers, and then we've got our floor joists that sit on top of that. So the center of the house does shrink or settle more than the outside, so things tend to go a little bit bowed towards the middle. So the question would be, okay, is it actually truly the piers sinking, or is it a wood shrinkage issue? If the piers are truly sinking, then yes, we need to do some pretty quick fixes. My guess would be some concrete raising or some additional concrete footings and reshim the girder. But I would definitely check all avenues of possibilities before I just automatically assume the piers are sinking.
All right. And we'll go one more caller here on our line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Yes, thank you very much. Enjoy your show very much. I have a question about some siding that I'm getting ready to put on and what they're going to do. And also ventilation, too. First question is, they're going to take all my siding off and replace it, and one has talked about using the home wrap, and another one is talking about using this, oh, it's maybe a quarter inch, not quite. It's an accordion foam board, and it has holes in it, and one says you should use that because if you have a lot of insulation, your home's well insulated, which it is, it'll let that breathe. And then I'm also putting on the siding that has the foam on the styrofoam on the back of it. And my last question is, I will hang up and listen. He's also talked about in the gables of putting in the small octagon vents and opening them up for vents or closing them. And I'm wondering, I'm living out in the country on an 80-acre field and I get a lot of wind and snow. Would I possibly get some snow and stuff in them gable vents and...
Okay, I do recommend some type of a wrap. The foam board versus the house wrap, the house wrap probably does a little bit better job of sealing because it goes up in larger sheets, but the foam board is relatively effective, so I would say either one of them would be acceptable and recommended. The house wrap probably goes up in a little bit larger sheet, so it's probably a little bit easier to seal at all the edges. As far as ventilation goes, there's an old saying that says you can't get too much ventilation until we start getting water penetration. So you want to ventilate it as well as you can. If you're in a high wind area, then you have to use different mechanisms. The octagon vents that go on the outsides do allow occasionally high velocity rain and snow to blow through there. I like to see the ridge vent at the top plus some soffit vents and let natural convection do most of it. But if you're in a high wind area, you can end up with a problem of wind blowing in a ridge vent too. So if you give us a call, I'll try and work a little bit more with you on the phone.
Well, at that, we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of this time. We want to say thanks to Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. And we'll say we'll see you next time. We've promised that he'll be back in November. So almost on a Monday, he's here to take these kind of questions. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, David. I always have fun.